There we go. Last week we talked about the burnt offering, we talked about the grain offering, and we're talking about the peace offering. And there were just a couple of things I wanted to catch on that. So turn over to the 7th chapter, and let's look there. And then we'll just spend a minute there, and then I want to go over very quickly and start looking at the sin offering and the guilt offering, because I think that we'll find some interesting things there. So if we go over to the 7th chapter, we find a couple of things. First of all, as we look at probably around verse 11, the verses 11 to 21, it's talking about the sacrifice of a peace offering, but this time from the perspective of those who are kind of offering it. The earlier one is on the priest's perspective in the first three chapters, we said, and then as you get into chapters 4, 5, 6, 7, it's kind of from the offerer's perspective. And they talk about the same sacrifices, but they give you slightly different details in each one. So here he talks about it, and he says, this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which will be presented to the Lord. If he offers it by way of thanksgiving, then along with the sacrifice of thanksgiving, he shall offer unleavened cakes mixed with oil, unleavened wafers spread with oil, and cakes of well-stirred fine flour mixed with oil. With the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving, he shall present his offerings with cakes of leavened bread. Of this he shall present one of the offerings as a contribution to the Lord, and shall belong to the priest who sprinkles the blood of the peace offerings. Now, did you notice anything kind of different there when he's describing this one? What were some of the things you noticed? Yeah, in the previous one, in especially on the burnt offering, when it talked about, or the grain offering, what was it? Unleavened, right? No leavening. And here, we've got him offering leavened bread with it. What's the difference? What's that? Okay, physically, that's the difference. Reminds me of people ask, you know, why is the kettle boiling? You can get the scientific explanation about the heat and things like that, or the intent, which was, I'm trying to make a cup of tea. So both answers are right. When we get to this, yes, there's leaven and not, but why did God allow one in one place and not in the other?
The leavened bread was for the priest.
Okay, well, the priest would eat that. They also ate some of the unleavened bread. Turns out, he's just setting some ground rules for them, isn't he? And as with a lot of things, we may not know exactly all of the reasons there. But I want you to put yourself in the place of one of the priests. That you are responsible for walking people through this. As we described before, the people offering their sacrifices would have shown up at the curtains that were marking off that boundary area of the tabernacle. One of the priests would have come up to them and said, what are you offering today? Because he's got a menu, right? Now, would that priest have necessarily went, oh, peace offering, let me check my scroll? What do you expect about those priests and the book of Leviticus? I suspect they had it memorized, okay? So they knew exactly what they were supposed to do with exactly which offering. And I think that's really what we get out of this, is God was precise. He gave specific instructions, and those priests were required to follow those instructions. And they were the ones who were guiding the offers through the process. Now, they're also teaching these people, as they go, what the responsibilities are and things. But the priests would have been the ones to memorize it. So as it gets through here, and he's saying, okay, here's all the stuff. It's going to be well mixed. It's going to be just fine flour. Again, moving towards the, if you're going to give anything to God, what do you give? You give your best, right? So all of that comes down. Now, as for the flesh of the sacrifice, he starts giving some more instructions. On the burnt offering, what happened to the flesh of the sacrifice? All the meat and stuff. It's all burned up, okay? Well, in this particular one, it says, now as for the flesh of the sacrifice of his thanksgiving peace offerings, it shall be eaten on the day of his offering. He shall not leave any of it over until morning. But if the sacrifice of his offering is a votive or a freewill offering, it shall be eaten on the day he offers his sacrifice, and on the next day what is left may be eaten. But what is left over from the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day shall be burned with fire. So,
Little difference there too, right? We've got all these subtle differences when you start digging into it a little bit. Some of them, they could be eaten as a meal together with the priest and those who were offering, and it had to be done that day. Others, if there was leftovers, which everybody likes leftovers, I hope, okay, leftovers the next day. What about the third day? Nope. Okay, no leftovers for the third day. So if any of the flesh of his peace offering should ever be eaten on the third day, he who offers it will not be accepted, and it will not be reckoned to his benefit. It shall be an offensive thing, and the person who eats of it will bear his own iniquity. Now, you know, sometimes when we get to reading things, it almost looks arbitrary, doesn't it? I mean, what's the difference in 1 day versus 2 days versus 3 days when you start looking at, and once it's smoked on the altar, it's going to last for a while, right? It's not like this is a health regulation. I had somebody where I was talking to this about it go, oh, well, after 3 days, it's going to spoil or whatever. Nah, maybe, probably not. I mean, that's how many of you have eaten beef jerky? Yeah, most people, right? How long does that stuff last? You know, somewhere into the next century. So that's not the point. The point was, these were things that had rules that they were supposed to follow, and if they didn't follow the rules, what's he saying here? You didn't get any benefit out of this. So if you want to get the benefit, the rules are essential. And so that's one of the messages that I think comes across very strong here. Notice in verse 19, also the flesh that touches anything unclean shall not be eaten. It shall be burned with fire. As for other flesh, anyone who is clean may eat such flesh. Now we're going to go find some things who are unclean and things like that, but what do you think in this temple compound or this tabernacle compound would potentially touch it to make it unclean? Okay, lizard. We come from Florida. You're all over the place. That wasn't my first thought, though. What do lizards eat? Flies. Okay, so there is a big problem because those were unclean as well. Okay, so there could be some circumstances here where, you know, if it touches unclean things, what happens to it? It's unclean. Now, we had this rule when I was, my grandparents lived kind of out in the country in Alabama, and we quite often had, you know, family gatherings where all of the food gets put out on the table for the 4th of July, and there's just monstrous piles of food all over. And somebody's kind of got a flapper to sort of try to keep the flies away, right? But if a fly lands on the corn, what do? You brush it off, and then you scoop out your corn. We don't have quite the same, you know, intents of that, but why was he making the people do this? See, now we start getting into some of the things that, as we look in the book of Leviticus, we're going to see it later as he comes up, but there's a phrase that I think really gives you the intent of what God is trying to convey to people.
Yes.
God's words were, you will be holy because I am holy. That's the reason. I am holy. I want you to be holy. And so anything that was defiled, anything that could be seen as unclean, was not acceptable. And so they had to be careful with that sort of thing. And he's saying, guess what? Sacrifice should have been offered in good faith, gets defiled by something unclean. What do you do with it? You burn it up. You don't eat it. When anyone touches anything unclean, whether human uncleanness or an unclean animal or any unclean detestable thing, that's like swarming insects and stuff like that, those are flies, and eats the flesh of the sacrifice of peace offering, which belonged to the Lord, that person shall be cut off from his people. So, did they take that seriously? Pretty seriously there, okay? Let's jump down verse 28, he picks up there, he's got this little interim, and we'll come back to it on 22 verses to 27. But in 28, he says, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, he who offers the sacrifice of his peace offerings to the Lord shall bring his offerings to the Lord from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. His own hands are to bring offerings by fire to the Lord. He shall bring the fat with the breast, and the breast may be presented as a wave offering. I'm not going to read the rest of it. It goes on down. It gives a lot of details about it, about the thigh and what they're going to do, and the fact that all of this has been given as part of, if you look down in verse 34, it says, "For I have taken the breast of the wave offering and the thigh of the contribution from the sons of Israel, from the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them to Aaron the priest and to his sons as their due forever from the sons of Israel." So that which this is that which is consecrated to Aaron, and that which is consecrated to his sons from the offerings by fire to the Lord in that day when he presented them to serve as priests to the Lord. So, was there a hierarchy even among the priests? Yeah, there was Aaron and his sons who sat as in the priesthood. There were other Levites that served under them doing all kinds of other duties, but each person had roles to fill. Now we find out, when you go over to Numbers, anybody remember Korah's rebellion? Yeah, there was a time when the folks said, you know what? We don't like the way things are set up. We want to fix it. You know, anybody should be able to be a priest. And these were Levites who were wanting to do that. And so they had a little showdown, and it didn't work out so well. Earth kind of opened up, swallowed them all, closed back over. Plague started. Tough times there. God was showing his displeasure. So they've seen things like this. And so when you get down to this rule book and you say, if I want to offer a peace offering, now remember, that's a voluntary offering, right? Peace offering is voluntary. And he says, even if you're doing a voluntary offering and you don't do it right, there's no benefit. There's no benefit at all. Okay, any questions on peace offering then? We get down to the next one, sin offering and guilt offering, and those are very closely related. Some people think that's just slight variations on the same thing. They're both for sin. They're both when you talk about guilt. So we're going to go back over to chapter four in just a second to pick up there. But before we do, we got some words that we need to make sure we all understand a little bit. Okay, we're going to play with words here for a minute. First word is atonement. So I need some help. What is atonement? Give me a definition.
Forgiveness.
Okay. Forgiveness.
Payment.
It's a payment. Okay. In the New Testament, we see the word propitiation, which is also related to this word atonement. What else? I can see the wheels turning.
Is it related to appeasing?
Okay. There is that part of appeasing, but I like these two things. It's the reconciliation of God and man. Reconciliation. Putting them back together. What does sin do? It separates us from God. Atonement is that process by which we are reunited with God. Reparation for an offense or injury. Whose reparation? God's, because who's the offender? That's us, right? And so atonement was when this reparation was made. What form did the reparation take for them? The sacrifices. And so that the offering was to God in order to ask God's forgiveness and to achieve atonement. So let's talk about forgive. What does it mean to forgive? If you look at forgiveness and look it up, it'll say the act of forgiving. It's like, this doesn't help. So you got to go all the way back to the root, which is forgive, right? So what does it mean to forgive? Okay, to cancel a grievance, erase a debt. What else? I found three dictionary definitions, and they're all very interestingly related when you think about forgiveness. So you can forgive a debt. What if I just forgive someone? What is that? Okay, a pardon. I am no longer going to hold this to their account, even though they may not owe me anything in terms of a debt or whatever. But I kind of like the way it said. It's to give up resentment of or a claim to requital. Does that make sense?
to give up the resentment. That kind of rings home a lot, doesn't it? What does that mean when you need to forgive somebody? You're not really forgiving them unless you can get rid of the resentment. That's where forgiveness goes. Or how about to grant relief from a payment? That was one of the ones we got. Or to cease to feel resentment against. So in each of those, that's what forgive means, right? How about this one? We're going to read, and it's going to talk about the one who sins unintentionally. Now this one we have to be a little careful of, because there's really a contrast between this and in Numbers 15. He doesn't cover it in Leviticus here, but it's over in Numbers 15 towards the end, and we'll look at that in just a second. He talks about deliberate sin. So unintentional, we have kind of a normal way we think of unintentional. What does that mean? I didn't mean to, right? That's an accident. That's kind of the sense that we get from unintentional. It's actually, if you look at the Hebrew background for it, it's a little broader than that. What it really means is, I mean, you may have had knowledge that what you're doing is wrong, but it's one of those cases where you recognize it and you go, shouldn't have done that. Right? Anybody ever had those moments where you said something or done something and then you go, okay, that wasn't right. I shouldn't have done that. That's still unintentional. There's a difference between the way the will is directed there. What is one of the best ways, I think, of thinking about unintentional sins is if you find out that you've done something wrong, what's your first reaction? Is it defiance? Or what's the other option? Repentance. I'm sorry. Right? So that's where you get this concept of those, when it comes to their notice or when it's brought to their notice or when they find out or when they realize it, that's the unintentional sin. The implication for what we're going to read is they've gone and decided, I need to repent of this, right? That's why they're bringing the sacrifices, theoretically, is that their heart says, I need to repent of this. But I want to contrast this. So intend is to direct the mind on. So they may have known it was wrong, but as they're directing their mind and unintentionally go, you know what? That was dumb. Shouldn't have done that. We've got to fix it. But defiance. Somebody turn over to Numbers, the 15th chapter. In Numbers 15, he's going through a list of some of the sacrifices, just like he's going through here in Leviticus. And I haven't pulled all of those references in, but sometime after you look at this, you ought to read through just Numbers, the 15th chapter. It'll give you that. But he adds one more here that's not in Leviticus, because Moses is given a different kind of set of instructions. And these aren't the people that are going to show up at the gates of the tent area, right? So what does it say? Somebody read Numbers 15, 30 and 31. Dave?
But the person who does anything with a high hand, whether he is native or sojourner, reviles the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among the people. Because he has despised the word of the Lord and has spoken and broken his commandment, that person shall be utterly cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him.
Okay, so which version were you reading from?
ESV.
ESV, okay, so that has high handed there, okay? What are the words that you find in some of the other translations? Defiant is what it says in the New American Standard. But you get the impression there? What's somebody who's defiant, what's their attitude? Well, it's the disposition to resist. Think of it this way. Saul is told to wait for Samuel. He can start waiting. So what does he do? He offers the sacrifices. Samuel comes up and goes, what? What have you done? What's Saul's first answer? You were late. I had to. It's not my fault. Right? It's your fault. You were late. What's that? That's being defiant. And we see examples of that all through the Old New Testament, do we not? As people come up against God's rules, God's limits, and when it doesn't suit them, they want to be defiant. Now, interesting thing about this in Numbers 15. That's where it ends in that discussion on the sacrifices. If you look at verse 32, it begins with an interesting thing. There was a man who was picking up sticks on the Sabbath day. And so some folks grab him, and they take him to Moses, and they say, what are we going to do with this man? And what was the penalty? Anybody remember? They stoned him. Now, why do you think they did that? And why is that located right after these verses? What does it mean when he says he shall be cut off from among the people? Yeah, that's kind of like the ultimate cut off from among the people, isn't it? And the idea that I get there is, here's an example of someone who did something defiantly. They knew what they were supposed to be doing. They didn't care. It wasn't like, oh, shouldn't have done that. The picture I get is, there's a guy who looks out and goes, there's nobody else gathering wood. It's kind of like my wife when she wants to go to HEB. And I was like, there's nobody else there. Let's go right now, real quick, early before the crowds get there, right? And he's thinking on the Sabbath day, this is a great time to go do it because nobody else is. I'm there in a desert, and there's not a lot of wood around. So you get first pick on the Sabbath day. But that was the whole point. God said, not to be done. All right, so keep those in mind. But then I want to ask you another question, because we talked about this when we looked at the book of Hebrews, and that is the idea of forgiveness of God. We've looked at forgiveness, we've looked at atonement. I want you to look at how many verses, just in these first few chapters of Leviticus, talk about the priest's role and the sacrifices and what was done there. Leviticus 4:20, the priest shall make atonement for them and they will be forgiven. 4:26, the priest shall make atonement for him in regard to his sin and he will be forgiven. Thus the priest shall make it. You get the idea? Over and over and over again. Now what does that tell you? They're going to be doing it a lot. What else?
Looks like forgiveness goes with it.
Forgiveness and atonement are linked, right? Each one of those. The priest shall make atonement, but who does the forgiving? God does the forgiving. So there's several things we get out of this. Could they be forgiven of their sins under the old law? It says, they shall be forgiven. They shall be forgiven. God forgave them. We need to understand that God's forgiveness was conditional on them doing what he asked them to do. It's the same as it is today. Conditional on doing what God wants. What was the difference in these sacrifices? And we're going to talk more about that as we start looking at the sacrifice of Christ. If I went and I offered an offering for my sin, and the priest makes atonement and says, God has forgiven me, and I head back home and I commit another sin, now what? Go back with another sacrifice. It was an endless trail of sacrifices. Not that God wouldn't forgive them, but the conditions for forgiveness were along the lines of what you could offer. And when it talks about in Hebrews, the bloods of bulls and goats couldn't forgive sins? What's he mean there? That's this exaggeration for the sake of emphasis. It's not that they couldn't be forgiven, but what state would they be in? They're always in a state of a problem, sins I may not even know about. And so once a year, they had to go in to the high place, and the priests offered sacrifices for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. They didn't even know they had. They weren't going to bring an offering. They didn't know. You think we've ever committed any sins and had no idea what we'd done? I suspect that's the case. What's the difference between then and now, then? We have one sacrifice. And the sacrifice has been done. So we can appeal to that sacrifice. When you look at those old sacrifices, it said the blood of bulls and goats, was that an equitable offering? No. It would be the equivalent. I said this before. If Rob owed me money, and I said, you know what? I know you can't pay that amount. Why don't you just give it to me and I'll take it. And I agree to accept monopoly money for whatever this debt was. Now, is that an equitable exchange there? Not even close. But I forgave the debt, right?
I think it was one of those things.
Okay.
You didn't ask the wife if that was okay.
Yeah, it could have been. Could have been. Yeah, yeah. That we would definitely want to get agreement on that. But when you see what I'm saying, though, about God accepting. What he wanted was their hearts, right? That's really the currency that God wanted out of them. was that they were following his rules because they loved him and they wanted to get it right. What's God's attitude today? It's exactly the same. And I think that's one of the lessons that we see here. So why did he make all these sacrifices and things?
Well, when he's saying the blood of bulls and goats are not what he's looking for, they're saying the blood of the bulls and goats isn't enough for sacrifice. What he was trying to get them to understand was the cost of death, the cost of blood, the cost of the constant ugliness of sin.
And we talked about what that area would have looked like with them, you know, killing animals all the day long and the rivers of blood that would have flowed out of this place as a constant reminder of just how bad sin was in God's eyes. But even if we look at Micah 6, you know, when he's asking, what will I bring to the Lord? The Lord want thousands of rams? 10,000 rivers of oil? Maybe my firstborn? No. That's not what he wants.
Well, even later in the Old Testament, he tells them that your sacrifice he doesn't accept because he doesn't want the sacrifices. He wanted obedience.
In Isaiah, he comes up right in the first couple of chapters talking to them about, I've had enough, because they weren't offering it in faith. They were just following the steps. They might have been doing it exactly right according to the rules, but their hearts weren't in it. You had to have both of these in order for this to be acceptable. So as we look at this burnt offering and go down to the sin offering here, in chapter 4, we're not going to read through all of this. I encourage you to read it yourself, but I want to take a look at a few verses. So he starts out and he says, then the Lord spake to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a person sins unintentionally in any of the things which the Lord has commanded not to be done and commits any of them, if the anointed priest sins, so he's taking anyone, so that's this general category, then he's going to start breaking it down. So in verse 3, who does he start talking about? The priests. They're the first up. Why would he start with the priests?
Why would he start with the priests?
They were leadership.
They were leadership.
Yeah, get it right before they make an offering.
Yeah, how's a priest going to offer for you if the priest still has sin on his conscience? So the priest has to be consecrated first before they can help others. Even on the Day of Atonement, before the high priest could go into the most holy place, what did he have to do first? And we'll read that when we get there, but he had to offer sacrifices for himself first before he could go in and offer sacrifices for the people. So he says, even the priests can get caught up, and I demand holiness. So if the priest gets caught up, guess what? Sacrifice. And he was required to do that. Now he goes through a lot of details, dipping fingers in the blood, sprinkling it around, putting some of the blood on the horns of the altar. He's talking about the altar of incense that was inside. So there's a number of things he has to do there. Verse 8, he's removing all the fat again. Remember, we read all about that. We got our anatomy lesson for how the animals are taken apart and which parts are burned. And he goes on with this being a bull, in this particular case, and he says, but the hide of the bull and all of its flesh with its head and its leg and its entrails and its refuse, that is all the rest of the bull, is to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. So it's kind of interesting because some of these sacrifices, especially now as we start listing some of these, some of the, with the offal, the guts and skin and head and things like that, were not burned completely up on the altar. They're taken out to the ash pile and then even burned there. So they're still burning them up, but it's outside the camp. But it says, it's interesting, it says it was a clean place. Ash pits don't necessarily equate to clean to me. You know, when I've cleaned out fireplaces and things like that, it's kind of a messy job. So is he talking about that kind of clean? No, it's a consecrated place. It's a place that's set aside. It's a place where people had respect for what was there, which was the ashes of the sacrifice. So he says, not necessarily all of it on the altar, but we're going to go out here, and it's still treated with respect, right? Because it was an offering to God. So priest says, he's got a job to do. Okay, so take a look at verse 22. Well, verse 13. Who's he talk about in verse 13? The whole congregation. Now, this is one of those where I scratch my head sometimes and go, the whole congregation missed something.
I'm not sure exactly how that goes, but is it possible for a whole group to kind of get involved in something and then later find out, oops, that's really not the right way to go? Yeah, it is. It's also possible that, you know, a leader decides something and everybody just goes along with it, and that's the whole group going away, the whole congregation. So there's a lot of different circumstances where this could occur, and if the whole congregation winds up saying, it was all of us, I found it interesting that as a group, they could offer the sacrifice, is what it really boils down to. It's not that every individual in that group, if it was, fell into that category, but they were to bring a bull as well. Now, the priest, he brings a bull. If the whole congregation goes, they bring a bull. That's a large animal. Okay? Anybody been on farms? Seen some of the bulls that are around? Yeah, my uncle raised cows, and he did not want to, he could go on the same pasture with his bull. It liked him. Didn't like anybody else. Large animal. Expensive animal. That's part of the whole point here, right? But now he goes on down and gives him very detailed instructions on how the whole congregation is going to do this. But it does in verse 15, it's the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be slain before the Lord. Why do you think it was the elders? And yes, I know, they probably couldn't get the whole congregation inside the tent area.
But what's the point of it being the elders? They're leaders, okay? Those who probably should have recognized that this wasn't the right way to go for the congregation.
They're the heads of the family.
Heads of the family in many cases, but so many times that was even an extended family. You know, this could have been several generations and who the patriarch of whatever family it would have been. And so they would be responsible for going in, putting their hands on this bull as it's being sacrificed, just like as an individual would do. They had, as a group, to perform the sacrifice. Then it gives more details about it.
Then it comes up to the next one. And in verse 22, who's it start talking about? The leaders, okay? Now, who's a leader? Could be one of the elders, could be one of the priests, could be one of the sub-Levites, any number of roles that fills. Whole point is, though, it's someone in a position of what? Responsibility. Responsible for other people. They're saying one of them commits a sin. All right? They've got a male goat, a little smaller than a bull, but still an animal that was part of the flock, or part of the herd, flock in this case. And so it goes through all that they had to do. And once again, read through this, because each time you're going to see where it says the priest dips his finger in the blood, he sprinkles it seven times before the Lord, and he puts some of the blood on the horns of the altar, and all of this ritual that he would go through. And you think about that, what was the whole point of, you think, sprinkling the blood and putting some of the blood on the altar and things like that? What are they doing? Besides making a mess. Have you thought about how much laundry the priest would have to do? What are they wearing? Linen, white linen. The poor ladies are probably, doing wash constantly, trying to keep these things white. But when you see the blood, what did he say in Genesis when Noah came off the ark? He said, you can't eat blood because life is in the blood. And when the blood is spilled out, what does that represent? Loss of life, that's death. So what they're doing is they're emphasizing this death. Are they not? And where are they putting it? On the horns of the altar before their God. That the blood has been shed. It is before their God. That they are realizing that this offering is just what they can and what they can do to ask God for his forgiveness. They are seeking atonement. God is giving the forgiveness. So, he gets down to verse 27. It says, if anyone of the common people sins unintentionally in doing any of these things, that's where most of us would have fit, right? and the common people. And then he starts going down the list there. And if his sin which he has committed is made known to him, he shall bring his offering a goat, a female without defect, for his sin which he has committed. He shall lay his hand on the head of the sin offering and slay the sin offering at the place of the burnt offering. The priest shall take some of its blood with his finger, put it on the horns of the altar of the offering, and the rest of his blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar. He shall remove all of its fat, just as the fat was removed from the sacrifice of peace offerings. And the priest shall offer it up in smoke on the altar for a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus the priest shall make atonement for him. He will be forgiven. But if he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin offering, he shall bring it a female without defect. And he goes on and talks about, again, all of the things. Why is he repeating this every time? We've got pretty specific instructions, and if you start looking at them, they're kind of almost identical as you go along. Remember what we said the priest was going to do? He's going to memorize this. He's probably going to memorize it in chunks. And so if you're doing a sin offering for an individual, you go right there. You don't have to go back up and refer back to anything else. You've got it right there, exactly what you're supposed to do. But there's another reason for repeating something like that.
Emphasis.
It's emphasis, is it not? God's given instructions for each one of these things. What's he expect? Follow it, right? Follow it. Can anybody accuse it of not being clear what the steps were on any of these? I don't think so. After you've gone through it 10 times, and I know it's easy if you're just doing your daily Bible reading, if you're reading through Leviticus, it's easy to get through about the first three, and then you're going, oh, it's another one. and it just seems like it's over and over. But it's not until you really get to looking at it and saying, what's the point? Kind of like Mark was doing this morning in Galatians, you say, what are the words that jump out at you? And those are the words that jump out at me. Atonement, forgiveness, the priest doing it. What's that? Somebody had another word. The altar, all of those things over and over again, putting the blood on the horns of the altar. Those come up again over and over. But you start thinking about, when it says common person, what if you're really poor? Well, in the fifth chapter, he goes on down. He says, okay, if you can't afford any of these, then what can you bring? You can bring a couple of turtle doves. And if you can't afford that, an ephah of flour. Okay, basically, what principle is that? Think about it for a second. You've got this range of things that could be brought. Which one do you select? The best you can, right? That's the point. The guy's rich and he goes, I don't see any lambs out there I want to get rid of. Oh, the flour. We'll do the flour. Is that the way it's supposed to go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Basically, it was, how high can I go before I just can't go any higher? That was the cutoff line. Why was it that Jesus marveled at the widow that put two mites in? Was that not exactly the same principle of giving what you could? And the way these sacrifices are laid out, they were giving to a herd. Because this wasn't just a rare occasional thing that happened. This was ongoing all the time. So, we learned looking at those sacrifices. We kind of covered all of them. We covered the last ones quickly there. Next week, what I want to do, read the last little bit. My wife loves this one. The 7th chapter, verses 22 to 27. Basic point is there, it's all the fat belongs to God. So, she still turns all over me and tells us the fat belongs to God. But the point there is, and he had rules about this, right? Okay? And he wanted them to follow it. But next week, I'm going to put a different chart up. I want you to think about, how does Christ fill these rules? Let's take a look at that for a few minutes next week as we start looking at if the sacrifices for them were this way.